Our next speaker is Peter Dale Scott. Peter's a former Canadian diplomat. As I mentioned earlier, he's professor of English emeritus at the University of California at Berkeley. Peter's been an anti-war speaker since during the Vietnam War period, and during the U.S.-Iraqi War. He was a co-founder of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the University of California, Berkeley, and of the Coalition on Political Assassinations. In addition to his book with Jonathan Marshall, which I've mentioned, Cocaine Politics, his other prose books include The War Conspiracy, The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond, Crime and Cover-Up, The CIA, The Mafia, and The Dallas Watergate Connection, The Iran-Contra Connection, which was also co-authored with Jonathan, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, and Deep Politics 2. Peter is also renowned in his work in poetry. He's the author of the trilogy Seculum, Coming to Jakarta, Listening to the Candle, and Mining the Darkness, and also Crossing Borders. I also want to point out that he's brought with him copies of a new study that he's completed, which is brings the Cocaine Politics book analysis up to date. And there are copies upstairs for those of you who'd like to purchase a copy, and I recommend it. So I'm very pleased to introduce Peter Dale Scott.
Thank you very much, David. Thank you for mentioning that I'm a poet. I'd like to begin by saying that sometimes it's helpful to be a poet and look at what's going on in society, because as a poet, I believe metaphors are important, very important. In fact, most of you wouldn't believe how important I think they are. And we have a metaphor here, the war on drugs, which is perhaps the most dangerous and pernicious metaphor that we have afoot in our society today. Imagine if we had a different metaphor, say if we're talking about a society that is addicted or a society that is sick or something, it would point us in a completely different direction. If we talk about a war on drugs, we have to figure out who are going to be our warriors, people like General McCaffrey, and who are we going to fight? And essentially, the primary targets of this war on drugs have been teenagers in this country and peasants abroad. We've talked about a national security threat here as if we're threatened by peasants in Bolivia, and we have turned life upside down in third world countries. And it has been accompanied by increasing violence. We know about the violence at home, the SWAT teams, the search and seizure, where it's unsafe to go out in certain neighborhoods at night, not because there are criminals, but because there are these DEA SWAT teams that may come, force you down on the ground, totally ignore your human rights and so on. It's even worse in the third world. So I think if we could end this terrible metaphor, war on drugs, it would set us on a better course. But of course, that's really asking for a structural change in this society, because that metaphor is rooted in a society that reaches to violence to solve problems. I'm going to talk quite a lot about the CIA today, but I want to agree, not exactly, but roughly, with what Alex said. This is not just a story of the CIA. I'm going to be talking a lot about recent revelations, starting with Gary Webb in 1996, and let me just ask now, how many people know something about what Gary Webb said in 1996? Well, that's very helpful, because then I won't tell you something that you already know.
Who's Gary Webb?
we'll get to this in a moment. What Gary Webb was talking about, the CIA's army, the Contras, and how Contras were continuously allying themselves in one way or another with drug traffickers, and how this radically increased the flow of drugs, primarily cocaine, into this country. But I want to say that the problem is not just the CIA here. It is a U.S. government policy. And it wasn't other agencies also involved, the military, the DEA, and then certain private elements which were relatively low scale in the Contra era, but which we should really focus on because they are becoming extremely important in our new millennium as we go off to fight wars in Kosovo and Colombia. Anyway, the primary decision which led, I think, to this unholy alliance between the Contras and drug trafficking was made in the White House. In fact, it was probably made by some of Reagan's electoral backers. We had an extraordinary number of war criminals from Central America who turned up at Reagan's inaugural in 1981 because a lot of money from Latin America flowed into his electoral coffers. And he had promised, and he delivered, a war against the left, particularly in Nicaragua. And the first alliance was made with Argentina. Well, it was no secret that the way Argentina ran these things, it was their modus operandi, was to fund their foreign covert operations from the drug traffic. So we made a decision to ally ourselves. Initially, it was not going to be primarily Americans on the ground. It was going to be the Argentines who would have run it. But Americans came down to be liaison, and the first people that they made contact were various military figures in Central America, all of whom had connections to drugs. This was before the CIA took over from the Argentines after the Falkland Wars, the Falkland Islands War, in which eventually America decided it had to side with Britain rather than Argentina, and that was led to essentially the withdrawal of the Argentines from the Contra scene. But it was just one phase, as Alex had said, in a continuous practice of when you want to go and stir up trouble, mischief, violence abroad, you ally yourself with people who are powerful in those regions of the third world. And time after time after time, these powerful people, the people who have the funds, the people who have the troops on the ground, have been local drug traffickers. This was the case in Central America. Now, a lot of this has been admitted, but the usual defense in the national press was, well, yes, we did have these unfortunate alliances, but it didn't make much of a difference to what's happening in the United States. This is absolutely false, and I'd like to start with the example of Afghanistan. In 1979, which is the year that I'm afraid to say Carter and his national security advisor Brzezinski, whom I went to college with, decided to back guerrillas in Afghanistan who already had heroin labs. There was no secret about how they were supporting themselves. We made that decision in 1979. How much of their heroin was coming to this country? None. By 1984, and this is according to Reagan's State Department, 54% of the heroin coming into this country was coming from the Pakistani-Afghan border. It was coming from those same heroin labs that I've just been talking about. And actually, the trucks that took CIA materiel and assistants and advisors up into the region were the same trucks that brought the heroin back out. So it went to 54%. So you can't say that it's not a problem. I'm going to talk in a minute or two about a single CIA asset in Central America, Juan Ramon Mata Ballesteros, who was a trafficker in Honduras, which was, by coincidence, where the heart of the CIA-backed Contra effort was. And the CIA used his airline, SETCO, to supply the FDN camps. That was the main Contra faction in Honduras. So that the CIA was protecting Mata Ballesteros. Was this a big problem? You bet it was, because the DEA at this time had already pinpointed a single cartel which they said was responsible for maybe a third and maybe a half of the cocaine coming into this country. When they first made the estimate, they saw four big people in the cartel, three of whom were Colombian and one was Mata, Honduran, who spent a good deal of his time in Colombia. But by 1985, they had decided that Mata Ballesteros was the most important of the four. And by 1985, the DEA had another reason to hate Matta and to want to get him, which was the murder of one of their agents in Mexico, Enrique Camarena. And in the end, Matta was brought to this country and convicted, not of the murder, but of the kidnapping, because they had tapes of the meeting in which they heard Matta Ballesteros meeting in Mexico, and this gives you a clue to what Mexico is like, with not only a bunch of the top drug traffickers, others also of whom these drug traffickers supported the Contras in various ways, but also top police officials from Mexico City, including one who was named the chief of Mexico City police years after this happened and years after he had been identified by the DEA as one of the people who were there. And this was under the supposed reform administration of President Salinas de Gortari. So when I say that the people on the scene are part of the problem, the right-wing elements and the way that those societies have become organized is a way which incorporates drug traffickers into the ruling structure of those countries. The Sandinistas in Nicaragua tried to put an end to that, largely because the Guardia Nacional under Somoza were so deeply implicated with the drug traffic, with prostitution, with all of the leading criminal operations in Nicaragua, that even the bishops had united to say, please do something to end this kind of regime. So that, ironically, you had a lot of church people backing the Sandinistas and the drug people, of course, trying to restore the status quo ante as soon as possible. And the consistent policy of the U.S. government, but here I do have to say the CIA in particular, was to back the elements of the old National Guard, who had been involved in these traffics for a long time, to make them predominate over other reformists who, like Aidan Pastora, who became alienated from the Sandinistas, wanted to join an anti-Sandinista effort, but wanted nothing to do with the criminals in the FDN, which was the CIA's faction, which was the Guardia Nacional faction. And a good deal of the very complicated Contra politics of the 1980s is the CIA trying to force the old Guardia Nacional, and Enrique Bermudez in particular, down the throats of a much more complicated scene on the anti-Sandinista side, many of whom wanted nothing to do with that. Well, now we come to the Gary Webb allegations. Who is Gary Webb? If you want to know, if you really don't know who Gary Webb is, you should buy this book upstairs.
If you had identified him by what he did, I'd know.
Yes, he had stories in the San Jose Mercury in August 1986, which alleged in sum that there had been two drug traffickers, Norwin Meneses and Danilo Blandon, both Nicaraguans, who had met Enrique Bermudez, the head of the FDN, way back in 1981, just as all of this was getting started. And Enrique Bermudez had said, and this is conceded by Blandón, the end justifies the means, you will find a way to support us. And even Meneses, who says, Blandón says, yes, he did say that. Meneses said, no, I never heard anything like that. But even Meneses said, yes, we worked out an arrangement whereby we would support the Contras. Well, who was Meneses at the time? The number one drug trafficker from Nicaragua, and everybody knew it, and certainly Bermudez knew it. So that was how all of this got started. And Meneses sold the cocaine wholesale to Blandón. Blandón sold it to a black called Ricky Ross, who was responsible for turning it into crack and selling it in South Central LA. And Gary Webb relied very heavily on a story in the Los Angeles Times from 2 years earlier that had called Ricky Ross the king of crack. It was a story by a man called Jesse Katz, and he said if there was ever anyone who was responsible for the crack epidemic in this country, it was Ricky Ross. Well, Ricky Ross at that time was getting most of his cocaine from Blandone, who was getting his cocaine from Manessis. And then the next thing that Webb said, and it turned out to be true, was that as long as there were Contras, the law enforcement people, although they knew everything about what Blandone and Manessis were doing, they couldn't touch them. They were untouchable. And it was only after the Contra support effort ended with a congressional vote in 1988 that finally the U.S. authorities moved against Blandone. They got Blandone to become an informant, and they set up, and that's the word, Ricky Ross. So the black dealer at the bottom of the totem pole, Ricky Ross, ended up with a life sentence, which he's serving now. Blandone was let off for this heroic act of turning in one of the people he sold to. And Manessis was never touched by the Americans at all, but he went back to Nicaragua and was caught flagrante delicto with a load of heroin by the Nicaraguans and was arrested there. And in Nicaragua, the press called him El Rey de la Cocaína, the king of cocaine. Nice people. Whoops, I have 2 minutes. Woo. Well, now I'm going to have to change what I was going to say. How many people, those of you who do know about Gary Webb, know that the House Committee on Intelligence recently produced a report which says there's nothing to his stories? How many people knew that? How many people saw my op-ed in the Chronicle on Monday? It's the same people, largely. Well, I'm very concerned about this because the only time that the American people really became aware that something terrible is being done to them and CIA policies and government policies are a factor in this terrible thing was over these Gary Webb stories. They were not perfect. I could have criticized, I did criticize one or two things in them myself, but in his broad outline, everything that I've reported to you today from what he said has been admitted not only by the Department of Justice in their Inspector General's report, but even by the CIA. The CIA Inspector General, Fred Hitz, did two reports totaling about 700 pages or so. I mean, it's heavy slogging through it, but I have slogged through it, and I have summarized them in here. And the summaries of those reports are pretty mealy-mouthed, but the contents of the reports reveal things like, well, we come back to Mata Ballesteros, for example. The Justice Department came over and said to the CIA, what do you have on this airline Setco? And they sent back a flat-out lie. They said there are no records of a Setco air. And not only did they lie way back then, but when Fred Hitz was trying to find out who wrote this, everyone said, it wasn't me, it was that guy. And this guy said, well, yes, I wrote it, but I never heard of Setco. And then the third guy said, well, the second guy actually used to go to the Setco headquarters quite often. So there was lying not only then, there was lying in the last couple of years. And those of you who remember John Deutsch in South Central LA, he said, if we find any wrongdoing, those people will be punished, I promise you. So the promise is still there, and it's up to people like the people in this room whether a House report that comes in, it's full of lies. I list the lies in my book. They say that no, the FDN would never have taken any drug monies. The Hitz report is full. It names the names of FDN leaders who were suspected of drug trafficking. There was a statutory requirement to suspend aid to any group whose members had been found to be guilty of drug trafficking. And the FDN was certainly true of this in that statutory period, but the CIA went blandly ahead. So the question is whether people like the people in this room will insist on the truth coming out, on there being a factual accounting. We don't have the whole of the Hitz reports yet. The second report looks into Southern Air Transport, which may have been the biggest drug trafficker of all, a former CIA proprietary, and there's only one page in its report because I think they've censored the rest. So we need to get those reports, and believe me, we need to get Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi, whose name is on this report, to repudiate this report. The chair of her committee was a former CIA officer. The chief of staff, how did she ever accept a chief of staff, a former CIA officer who spent 13 years working with those heroin trafficking Afghan guerrillas I was just talking about? How does somebody like that end up being in charge of a report that whitewashes the CIA? And let me just say, echoing something Alex said, this is my last sentence. Maybe a wrong one, but it's my last sentence. If we don't stop this thing here at home, we are going to see a war on drugs destabilize the whole of Central America, which achieved peace in the 1980s by keeping U.S. troops out, and now we're sending them back in under the guise of the war on drugs. And Colombia is going to be another Vietnam if we don't stop it by stopping the lie on which it is based. And I could say so much more about that, but maybe we'll come back to that in questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. I should mention that in the packets, that if you got a packet, there is a copy of Peter's, the op-ed we placed in the Chronicle on Monday that Peter wrote. And if you don't have it, we can get a copy for you. Our third speaker, pardon me?
Can you get a copy for me?
Sure. our third speaker, as I mentioned earlier, is Jonathan Marshall, former economics editor at the San Francisco Chronicle. He also authored the weekly column on economics at the Chronicle. He received his bachelor's degree in history with distinction, Phi Beta Kappa from Stanford University, and master's degree in American history with honors from Cornell University. Jonathan has been studying the drug traffic and drug policy issue for many years. As a college student, he published a pioneering scholarly study of the development of the opiate traffic in nationalist China, which shed new light on the origins of the U.S. intelligence complicity in the world narcotics business as far back as World War II. When he was at Stanford, he worked with the historian Bart Bernstein, who's also one of the advisors to our journal, The Independent Review. As editorial page editor of the Oakland Tribune, he wrote a noted series of editorials, which won a very distinguished award, I should mention, calling for a serious consideration of drug legalization, a position that was loudly condemned by then U.S. Attorney Joseph Russianelli. Mr. Russianelli was later exposed as the U.S. attorney who, at the CIA's request, returned $36,000 that had been seized from a supporter of the Nicaraguan Contras, who was a major defendant in one of the West Coast's biggest cocaine cases. As a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, Jonathan wrote investigative stories that uncovered drug trafficking crimes by a leading Israeli cabinet member and by a Nicaraguan trafficker and Contra supporter, who's also always been mentioned, Nora Meneses, who was later the subject of, as Peter said, Gary Webb's expose in the San Jose Mercury News. Among other books, including Cocaine Politics, Jonathan is author of the book on drug policy, Drug Wars, Corruption, Counterinsurgency, and Covert Operations in the Third World, a book which is more relevant, we believe, today than ever, in light of the Clinton administration's apparent determination to indeed turn Colombia into what could become another Vietnam. I'm also pleased that Jonathan was involved in a book project that I organized back in the early 80s that was published called Dealing with Drugs, and for which we won an International Book Award. I'm glad to present Jonathan Marshall.
Thank you, David. There really, I think, broadly defined two drug problems in the United States. One is the problem of drug misuse, frequently termed drug abuse, which is always a strange term, the thought of us abusing these drugs. But as Alex said, there is a real problem there. It's a medical and social problem, very real. There are people who die from drugs. There are people who are born with drug problems, crack, so-called crack babies, and so on. But the other problem, which I think is every bit as large and much more easily controllable, is the enormous social problem from what we call drug enforcement, and is really better, I think, thought of as drug prohibition. No one is really making war on drugs, they're making war on people. People who take drugs, people who engage in the commerce around drugs, and so on. And the nature of this so-called drug war is to abet violence in our society, corruption, the promotion of organized crime, and vast underground markets, the diversion of ever-increasing resources in the criminal justice system and military agencies to this fight, the enormous environmental harm that was alluded to in the third world, where drug crops are grown and where U.S. programs are involved in wholesale spraying and use of toxins and viral agents and other things to destroy crops. Onto the enormous medical harm caused by the diversion of these markets into underground channels where unscrupulous dealers cut drugs with unknown agents and so forth, and addicts use dirty needles, promoting the AIDS epidemic and a number of other enormous health problems. Another enormous casualty of this so-called drug war is one that's, I think, common to all wars, and that is truth. The kind of lying and hypocrisy that has been talked about it by my predecessors on this panel are really endemic to this whole war on drugs and have been just pervaded the entire government approach. I want to talk today a little bit about some of the domestic consequences of the war on drugs that I think are forcing a lot of people to rethink the social costs and the kind of wisdom of continuing current policies. The first point, I remember first learning in school about the scientific method and how you test hypotheses, and when they're clearly disproven, you move on and try another hypothesis. For decades, we've been testing the hypothesis that law enforcement would somehow diminish the availability of drugs and thus the social acceptance of drugs. It seems to me that's an hypothesis that's been clearly disproven. Just to take an example, from 1985 to 1995, the federal drug control budget increased from about $2.5 billion to more than $13 billion, a pretty healthy rise. Over the same period, the percentage of high school seniors who said that marijuana was easily available rose from 85% to 90% and has continued to rise. Similarly, the fraction of seniors who said heroin was easily available rose from about a third rose to about a third in 1988 from about 19% in 1979. Looking abroad, the expenditure of over $600 million in counter-narcotics programs in Colombia, which is soon to be dwarfed by the Clinton administration's proposed massive interventions, from 1990 to 1998, led to Colombia replacing Peru and Bolivia as the major source of cocaine in Latin America. Now, there was a great victory for law enforcement. The biggest test of drug availability is a simple economic one: what's the price? And there the evidence is pretty compelling that the price of drugs has fallen dramatically. A gram of cocaine cost only $44 in 1998 on the street, down from $191 in 1981. Heroin prices had been $1,200 per gram in 1981. They fell to only $318 per gram. In fact, heroin became so cheap that people started smoking it. So, in effect, traffickers are saying, when supply goes up, price goes down, and supply has gone up plentifully. Anyone who thinks for even a couple of minutes about the issue of drug interdiction, to which we spend countless billions of dollars, would quickly realize what a hopeless task it is and what a fundamentally dishonest task it is. The United States has 20,000 kilometers of coastline, more than 7,500 miles of border with Mexico and Canada. No army in the world could keep drugs out. People can produce methamphetamines in their bathtubs. Indeed, a single suitcase of fentanyl, which is a synthetic opiate, would be enough. It's so powerful, a suitcase full could basically supply the entire U.S. addict population for a year. So drug interdiction is at its heart. The only reason we buy drugs from abroad is because of cheap labor. It's cheaper to produce it abroad. But if the price went up a little bit, we'd produce it at home. It's called import substitution. So what are some of the social costs? Some of these have been alluded to, for example, the enormous erosion of civil liberties. When you look at almost every Supreme Court case that has eroded Fourth Amendment protections against searches and seizures, almost invariably they involve drug searches. And the reason is simple. There's no victim around to tell the police a crime occurred. The only way the police can find out that a crime occurred is by seizing property, invading people's cars, their homes, and so forth, on minimal cause to find evidence of a crime. I think it's interesting, the statistic that in 1996, 71% of all wiretaps were authorized for state and federal narcotics enforcement. In contrast, only 2.8% of wiretaps were for kidnapping, extortion, larceny, theft, loan sharking, usury, and bribery combined. And lastly, just one little point, those of you who remember Watergate, the infamous Plumber's Squad, which was at the heart of the Nixon operations, actually had its origin as a kind of extra-constitutional White House-led anti-narcotics squad, which became adept at breaking and entering, and then was put to other uses. We're all aware of third world corruption. Corruption has been quite pervasive in the United States as well due to the millions of and billions of dollars available by traffickers to corrupt law enforcement. Half of all police officers convicted as a result of FBI-led corruption cases between 1993 and 1997 were for drug-related offenses. One of the most obvious social costs of the war on drugs are clogged jails and prisons. In 1973, there were 300,000 arrests for drug law violations. By 1996, that number had risen to 1.5 million, a fivefold increase thanks to the war on drugs over that period. Three quarters of those arrests were for simple possession of a controlled substance, not even for sale or manufacturing of the drugs. By 1995, a quarter of all adults serving time in jails and prisons were there for drug law violations. The growth in the prison population from 1985 to 1995, over 80% of that increase was due to drug convictions. And so on it goes. By the late 90s, the cost of incarcerating all the people who were there simply for drug crimes had risen to about $9 billion a year. Well, if all this were really doing a lot to decrease real crime and make people feel safer, there might be a point in spending all that money. But many authorities have found quite the contrary. And two economists, who David mentioned earlier, Bruce Benson and David Rasmussen, actually studied the data, and they showed that the diversion of law enforcement to fighting drug crimes away from other more significant violent crimes has actually led to a reduction in law enforcement of things like murder, assaults, et cetera, the kinds of crimes most people feel threatened by. And numerous other authorities have remind anyone who cares to listen that crimes that are induced by drug altered states are far more common with alcohol than they are with illicit drugs that people get thrown behind bars for life. But the ideology of the war on drugs has been so penetrating and so pervasive and so rigidly enforced by the government that even credible experts have been silenced. And the most notable case, I think, are medical experts who, to take an example that David mentioned earlier, overwhelmingly medical experts agree that there are important medical uses for cannabis. Reducing nausea from chemotherapy or AIDS drugs is a classic example, and there are many others. And yet, the federal government has systematically, and this includes the Clinton administration, suppressed even government reports from medical authorities. The Institute of Medicine and many others have had reports suppressed because drug czars believe that this will somehow weaken our resolve to fight the war on drugs. Similarly, the federal government bitterly resists needle swapping programs. Roughly half of all AIDS cases in the United States result from intravenous drug use and the passing of contaminated needles. Every study on the book shows that clean needle programs would reduce the incidence of this horrible epidemic, but the White House refuses to budge on the issue. Similarly, countries in Europe, Australia, and so on are much freer in their use of methadone programs and so on to help addicts, opiate addicts. And these programs are usually suppressed in the U.S. government. Treatment programs receive very little support in total fraction of government resources in the so-called war on drugs. One report by the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration showed that about half of the need for treatment goes unmet in the United States. And this comes despite overwhelming evidence that treatment is effective not only in reducing drug use and in reducing crimes committed by addicts, but also even in things that such as treatment tends to reduce welfare use by 10%, increase employment 20% a year after treatment. So there's a whole range of areas that are improved by treatment programs. Treatment, of course, costs far less than imprisonment. To imprison a drug criminal costs on the order of close to $25,000 a year compared to treatment costs of about $2,000 to $6,000 a year. The RAND Corporation, which no one can view as a group of softies, estimated in the mid-90s that a dollar invested in drug treatment produced social returns on that investment of about $7.50 because of the reduction in crime and other sorts of problems. By contrast, they found that a dollar invested in controlling drugs in third world source countries resulted in a social loss of 85 cents. A dollar invested in interdiction resulted in a social loss of 68 cents. A dollar invested in domestic law enforcement led to a loss of 48 cents. These are pretty compelling numbers. Normally, one would expect fiscal conservatives to care about such numbers, but we don't see much of that from our current leadership. Well, what are the alternatives? The most radical one, which is almost never discussed, is because people are afraid of the L word, is legalization. And this is indeed a fairly radical proposal. It would base philosophically on the notion that people have the right to make choices about their own lives as long as they aren't doubling up other people's lives. And I don't want to push the legalization argument here too strongly, but I think there are a couple of facts worth remembering. One is that before 1914, drugs were largely legal, and there was not a gigantic addict population. There were people taking these little elixirs that Alex was referring to. Mostly they were functioning members of society. No one really knows for sure how many addicts there were, but some estimates put it as low as about 250,000. Certainly the United States had a sustained period of economic growth throughout this whole period of drug legalization. Some recent work by economists who studied the effect of changing prices on drug demand estimated the decriminalization of cocaine might lead to about 260,000 new users, and decriminalization of heroin might lead to about 47,000 new heroin users. These would certainly create social or medical problems. I hardly consider those numbers to be radically undermining of our society. Probably a more politically palatable alternative is often named harm reduction. And the notion here is to reduce the kind of wholesale incarceration of small-time drug users, to promote treatment as an alternative. It seems kind of criminal when there are people begging for treatment that society doesn't provide slots for them, that would condone the medical uses of drugs where prescribed by doctors, that would permit kind of hardcore drug users to receive heroin or methadone without resorting to black markets and the dangers of contaminated drugs, and so on. Programs like this are not just theoretical. They've been tried in Europe, in Switzerland, in Holland, and so forth. And careful scientific studies of the results have shown remarkably good effects. They don't show that drug use stops in these countries. They show that the kind of ancillary social harm that comes from enforcement is enormously reduced, that crime is reduced, that the health effects of drug use are enormously reduced, and that the problem becomes manageable rather than a severe social problem. I think there is hope in that a growing number of Americans are beginning to look to examples abroad of programs like this. There's hope in the fact that even stalwarts of the drug war from the Reagan era, like George Shultz, have started talking about drug legalization. Growing number of people are lending a certain intellectual respectability to this. You see them at the Hoover Institution, National Review Magazine, some people on the left. And that gives me hope that ultimately the American people will be able to change policy. But it is an extraordinarily hard fight against, as Alex said, very entrenched state interests in maintaining the drug war as it is for some very pernicious reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.